Hello, listeners. Welcome to Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Joe. I'm a musician, and each show I ask a guest musician to pick a song that we can listen to together. My guest today is Steve Kim. I'm so excited to have Steve as a guest on the show. He is one of the reasons that this show exists. Over the years, I've so much enjoyed talking with him about music and the creative process. So I want to welcome Steve. And Steve is an active bassist, composer, and teacher based in Seattle, Washington. He was a student of bassist Ray Brown and Gary Peacock and studied improvisation composition with Charlie Banakis. His live and recorded performances include appearances with Larry Coryell's 11th House, Don Mock, Dave Valentine, Jeff Simmons, Scott Kazoo, Garth Hudson, Ventures guitarist Noki Edwards, and on the 2014 release In Deep Owl by Soundgarden bassist Ben Shepherd. Steve has been commissioned to compose for the Southern Arts Council, the Seattle Arts Commission, the choreographers Bill Evans, Clay Taliaferro, and filmmaker Eric Patton. Steve, welcome to Human Music.
Well, thanks, Mira. It's really great to be with you.
I've been really looking forward to our conversation, and I know a little bit about your background in music, but why don't you share with our listeners a little bit about kind of your early music experiences, making music or listening to music?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually started out in traditional instruments. You know, my mother wanted me to play the violin and the accordion, and I washed out on those instruments really badly, right? And then she ran a boarding house. And so in her boarding house, there was a boarder who played an electric bass. And so I ended up with the electric bass and started playing and, you know, with my friends and in blues bands and so forth. And then went on to get into a music program in a community college. And then from there, started working as a musician. So early on, that was how it went for me.
And what do you remember about learning to play music? What was it attracted to you about making music?
Well, I was really having a lot of fun with my friends. All my friends were musicians, and so we would get together every day and play. And so it was just really a great social thing. And my friends were, you know, into listening to recordings. And so those recordings inspired, you know, everyone to try to emulate those people on the recordings. And it was just I remember it being a lot of fun, actually.
And what recordings were you listening to?
Oh, all kinds of stuff. You know, the popular rock bands at the time, Cream, blues bands, a lot of blues, Muddy Waters, etc. You know, I had a friend who I still see in Tacoma named Jay Maben, who had a giant record collection, just, you know, a couple thousand recordings. And so we would just listen at his house. His recording collection at the time was much larger than any other record collection that I knew of, certainly in libraries or in schools or anything. He just had more records.
It's funny.
And every night he was playing records, and you could go over and listen to him. And that's what he did. He just listened to records. And so if you wanted to hear more records, you just went and hung out with Jay.
That's awesome. Yeah, I recently reconnected with a high school friend of mine, and we were talking about how he was the one who knew about all the hip music that was happening. Mm-hmm. And back then, you didn't have the internet to research or listen to on Spotify, an endless stream
sure.
of music. You had to know somebody who knew what was happening, and that person was, you know, I told him that he was always considered one of the coolest people because he knew what was up. And then he shared all that music with us, our friends group. And so after you first started playing music, what was your musical journey after that?
Well, you know, for quite a while, it just was being a professional player, you know. So being a professional player requires one to, you know, acquire the skills that you need to do that, right? So for a long time, it was just acquisition of different skills, just so I could work. And that meant including playing music that you might not have, you know, chosen to play, because as a professional musician, many times one would play things that they don't actually like, you know. I mean, it's about employment at that point. So, you know, you try to do your best you can, and if you can, you know, you try to find something in there that you can relate to. I mean, there are people with the gift that love everything, you know, so they don't have that problem, right?
And were you learning on the job, or did you have formal musical education?
Well, I took a lot of instruction after I got out of school. You know, I was able to spend a year with a bass player named Gary Peacock, who was a great help to me. And much later in life, while I was working with a dance company, I was on the Centrum grounds, and Ray Brown was there for a week. So I spent part of that week with Ray Brown. And then I spent a long time studying with a teacher in New England named Charlie Banakis.
And what was it that made those teachers special to you? What was it that they brought to your playing, or to your thinking about music, or to creating music?
Yeah, well, I at that time, you know, I aspired to be a jazz musician. And so those were all, you know, established players and teachers in that genre. And so I was extremely lucky to contact them. They were at the very elite tier of, you know, what I was attempting to do at that time, you know?
Well, I think of you as an incredible teacher of music, and I've taken lessons from you, and I just appreciate your approach and your support. It's just this acceptance of whatever's happening in the moment, and then you respond to it, rather than you come to a session saying, these are the things I would like this person to learn. You really approach it from, where is this person at and how can I support them? And so I'm wondering, you know, what was it about those relationships, those particular people, that you were able to gain so much insight and learning from?
Well, first of all, thanks for that compliment, Mira. That's very nice. Thank you. I'm honored. But that kind of attitude that you're describing, it's just the attitude of the jazz player. And the jazz player, although many people think of it as a particular vocabulary, so what it really is a way to relate, you know, at its heart. You know, I mean, to have these conversations, sometimes you have to learn a very specialized vocabulary, you know. But once you have some of that vocabulary, the real art form is the conversation. And the conversation evolves around, you know, your rights and your responsibilities in a collective. So someone is going to play something sooner or later that you don't care for, or you would rather they have played something different. So the idea isn't that you change that. The idea is somehow you work with that, and you come to some point with it that I mean, you might not like it, but you can still work with it. And so really that's the issue is almost sociological, you know? And by the way, I consider that the great gift of jazz musicians, it is they show how to reconcile your differences with people that maybe have really radical differences with you.
It makes me think of collective painting where people, if you get them to a board and have them all start working on something, there's an intuitive thing that happens and everybody just organically starts to work together, which sounds very similar to what you're saying. There's this intuitive connection.
Yeah, that's true.
When you're experiencing that, can you describe that experience?
Well, yeah, it can be very emotional, you know, both of, you know, the kind of joyful that you have this kind of acceptance with a group, but also frustrating because, you know, sometimes, you know, one is disappointed, or one is can be angered also, you know, so there's a wide range of emotions that occur, and those are part of the experience.
When I hear that, it makes me think you're describing a spiritual experience, because there's a lot that comes up in terms of judgment in the moment. When I go through my day, it's so incredible how quickly I jump to judgment. And for me, the spiritual experience is to pause, get in touch with where I'm feeling emotionally, shift my thinking around it, and then be in the world in a different way than my initial reaction. And to me, that's a spiritual experience.
Oh, pardon me. Yeah, this sounds very similar, and I would just say that in playing with other jazz musicians, sometimes you don't have the luxury to stop, because
yes,
this is all happening in real time, and the better players actually respond so quickly. Sometimes you think, well, did that just really happen, or did I just think that? You know, I mean, I worked with Larry Coryell and his group one time, and they were so quick to respond that it was hard to tell where that came from. You just had to go with it, because if you just thought something, sometimes it would happen. Actually, I think what really happened is I would think something and play something, and they were so rapid in their response, you know. But in turn, they expected that same kind of reciprocal response from me. So you had to really be there now, you know.
It's very instinctual. And when I think about so-called primitive man, right, you know, that's a very loaded term, but there was this intelligence, this connection to this intuitive sense, right, that helped them respond to their immediate environment. And so it sounds a lot like just drawing on kind of our genetic makeup of that immediate intuitive reaction to the world, the universe, that connection to the planet, to the universe, to whatever matter we're made of.
Yeah, I could see that, because, you know, earlier on, you probably didn't have the luxury to hesitate because there might be wild animals, you know, or something, right? So you, if you were to survive, you had to, you know, react instinctively and quickly. But yeah, I think that has a definite positive role, you know, in interactions today.
And I also
but at the same time, you know, you just can't express everything freely all the time, you know. But I don't know if we live in that type of society And I don't know if we ever will, you know, but so maybe some discrimination is good.
Yes. Restraint.
Yeah, restraint.
I also hear you talking about craft, though, because in order to be responsive in the moment, there has to be what you were talking about earlier, that honing of skills, right? There has to be
Yes.
something that you can draw upon. And does that ever end? Was there ever a
No.
time where you felt like, okay, now I can do this?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm constantly thinking, yeah, now I can do this, and I'm usually wrong, you know, you know, I take a lot of inspiration from Michelangelo, who talked about the fact that in products of the human mind, complexity is a primitive state, whereas simplicity is the advanced state. So as things get simpler and simpler, I feel like I'm getting better and better.
Kind of back to the basics. Everything comes from the basics.
Or maybe it's just that you see what it really is in essence, and all the rest of the embellishment and all of that is not necessary.
Yeah, it's a special vision. Like, what do you hear? And then what does that bring up? It brings it back to the emotion. And I know that we've talked about emotion and music a lot and the power of emotion and how sometimes that is overlooked in music for the sake of craft or skill or prestige or something along those lines. But the greats can combine those two things.
Yeah.
You spoke earlier about the rights and responsibilities as a collective. I thought that was a really interesting way of phrasing that. What would you say those rights and responsibilities are when you're playing with a group of musicians?
Well, for example, I play bass. So as a bass player, there's certain responsibilities that are traditional in that a collective of jazz players. And although there's a wide range in which that can be interpreted in, generally speaking, you know, you're an accompanist. And, you know, you play time and you play the bottom parts of the music and so forth. So you're very supportive. But at the same time, maybe you have some kind of individual view on what that means. You have the right to express that.
I've been talking with my guest, Steve Kim, musician, bassist, composer. You're listening to Human Music on KVSH LP Vashon, your listener-supported island connection.
VOV programming is brought to you by Cafe Little Cup, featuring house-made bagels and Fioretta coffee, expertly roasted and prepared. Or enjoy wine by the glass and a baked treat in their Vashon Town Cafe. Don't forget grab-and-go specialty wines and pantry items on your way out. For hours of operation and to find out more, call 206-999-4742.
Support provided by Hawthorne Stereo, sellers of exceptional hi-fi since 1946. Hawthorne specializes in new and used stereo music systems, from vintage turntables to high-end digital streaming and beyond. You can find them on the web at hawthornestereo.com.
Welcome back to Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo, and I've been talking with my guest, musician Steve Kim. Steve, I've asked you to pick a song that we can listen to together. Could you introduce the song and talk a little bit about why you selected it?
Sure, Mira. The song I selected was by the composer Edgar Varèse, and it's called the entire it's titled Poème Électronique, or Electric Poem. And he was commissioned to do this piece for the 1957 Brussels World's Fair, and it was an especially built pavilion with 600 loudspeakers, and so you would walk through this, and then this composition would be playing. And I was introduced to this piece when I was a college student, and I've been listening to this piece for over 50 years.
Let's now listen to Edgar Varèse and his piece, Poema Electronicae. That was Edgard Varese, Poema Electronicae from 1958. Wow, what a composition. It was very much created a physical space, even though it was very sparse. And I'm wondering if it was that the fact that it was so sparse that created that space. And I was envisioning what it would be like to be at the Le Corbusier, listening to that. And that must have just been an incredible experience.
Must have been, right?
And I think that's why I like listening to Bach's experimental music, because it creates the space of my imagination. The different sounds emerge from the different areas of my brain and very much create that three-dimensional space. And I would call that like an imagination.
It's interesting, you know, Varese himself said that by the time one had heard the composition, the experimentation was over. You know, all the experiments were in the wastebasket, right? And so what you heard was the end product of the experimentation. And, you know, these days, a lot of the things that were just seemed so outlandish to people at the time, you know, the use of percussion and so forth and electronic sounds, which were extremely forward thinking at the time, you know, are just part of mass media now. And I think the whole idea is music can be envisioned as many sounds other than just the traditional 12 notes that we've chosen and made the tempered scale out of, you know, and if one thinks less conventionally, uses their imagination, like you had mentioned, more, you can just get things that are just much different, and we broaden the whole palette of things that are music.
Yeah, it makes me think of these attention engineered platforms that try to bring you out of your reality into another reality. And this music really forces you within your own reality and your own sense of space and imagination.
My sense is that those things just sounded correct to him. Although he seems very unusual even today, I think there's a lot of people who, you know, if they would just maybe release themselves from such conventional thinking, would think in different ways. And that's, I don't know if that isn't what art is really about.
Absolutely. I agree with that. The sounds, although they're electronic, there's the vocalization and the instrumentation, it all, when you put it together, is very organic sounding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the thing with him. He didn't really work from mathematical formulas like some of the composers at the time. And it was just all things that he thought sounded good and put them together in a very individual, organic way.
I've been thinking a lot about Chronos versus Kairos, these two terms, these Greek terms around different conceptions of time. And Chronos is linear, logical, measured in hours, minutes, seconds, and Kairos is more feeling, intuition, unpredictable, seizing the moment. And I think we spend so much of our time in Chronos time, and music, in this case, without a beat rhythm driving it, has its own internal rhythm. It creates that Kairos space for us, which is feeling and intuitive.
Well, that's interesting, because I feel that too. And at the same time, there is pulse in the world. And mm-hmm. and so pulse is, you know, some people would say pulse and steady time is a human derived thing. And of course in our society, you know, uniform time is kind of a requirement, especially in this country, since the advent of train travel. You know, it'd have to be 12 o'clock simultaneously in two places so you could have timetables and so forth. But also, you know, pulse, one's heartbeat, one's respiration, you know, the growth of one's hair. You know, all of these are on predictable periodic cycles. And so there is pulse in the world. So I think those two things that you mentioned, you know, there are two aspects of, for us, you know, our experience, that there is this kind of regulated, predictable, measured, and then there's a thing that's quite macro from that.
Thanks for the reminder, the nudge to think about pulse, that it's so true. It is structured, or there is this internal rhythm that we all experience, and it makes me think of the clave and the way that that's rhythm is described as more akin to a heartbeat rather than breaking it down by its rhythmic millisecond structure.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very physical thing.
Yeah, and that also brings when music like this can bring us so far into our body, and that's where the emotion lives. So there is something about the way that music enters our brain and then taps into the rest of our body in a way that you don't get from touch. And I have this crazy theory that, you know, the fear is not that there's going to be a computer chip in our brains making us into robots. The fear is that the computer-generated input manipulates our brain to create a reality that reflects a computer-generated reality rather than a physical, actual human reality. So I believe we don't actually need a computer chip in our brains in order for that to happen.
Well, you know, certainly computers are helpful, you know, gadgets, right? But at the same time, you know, they, you know, at best, you know, they, for example, AI is very good at creating a compendium of any particular subject at practically a moment's notice. But the issue with that is people create new things. people just don't reassemble things that have been done previously. People also can invent new things. And so, for example, a piece like Varese, it's so great because it shows us all the things that music possibly could be.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo, and I have been speaking with my guest, musician Steve Kim.
VOV programming support comes from Vashon Thriftway, locally owned and operated since 1965, and offering everything from organic zucchini to a hot latte or garden boots. Now supporting youth sports broadcasts on KVSH, you'll find them on the web at VashonThriftway.com.
Voice of Vashon thanks Windermere Real Estate for its support making our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Find them on the web at WindermereVashon.com.
Welcome back to Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo, and I've been speaking with my guest, Steve Kim. And he has an album out, A Saint's Past, A Sinner's Future. And I've asked him to talk about a song off of that album.
Well, thanks, Mira. This recording, I just finished it this year, and it features Dave Peterson, Hans Teuber, and Brad Gibson, some very fine musicians that I was able to work with. And the song that we're going to listen to is named Pentagraph. Penta is five, and I use the interval of fifths. So that's kind of the short answer on that.
Let's listen to Pentagraph. was Pentagraph from the album A Saint's Past, A Sinner's Future by Steve Kim. I love the slow progression of that song. It really invites you in. There's this comforting, we were talking about basic or simplistic structure, these intervals, but it allows for so much play and exploration. How did you go about this composition?
Initially, I just played the melody on bass, and then I have a particular kind of set of experiences from that, you know? And then I played the composition on piano. And for me, when I do that, it's like I'm playing a whole different piece of music because my experience is so different playing that instrument. So the instrument really kind of informs things, and certain things lie better on certain instruments than others. And then I played the song for these musicians, and basically what we hear now is their interpretation of what I originally brought them.
And so they composed those on their own, and then you all came together and brought it together in a recording?
Well, what happened was I played them my version of it. I played it on the piano. Then we played it a couple of times where they interpreted their own parts, you know? So essentially, although they played the parts that I wrote, they interpreted them individually. And then the interaction there is just a very spontaneous thing. Some of the parts, they left a space, and we all felt that, and then we would continue, and rather conversational.
Wow, that trust between you all really comes through. How long have you been playing with them? Is this something that has been developed over time?
I'd like to say yes, but actually no. Some of these players I played with on and off for a very long time, but this band in particular had never performed together before. But these are those types of players who try to develop that type of rapport in any ensemble they're in.
I think it also speaks to your comment earlier about just the desire to create something new that's within all of us, to push ourselves to explore new dimensions or whatever it is. I'm, you know, thinking about why have humans traveled all over the world and migrated back in the early days of Homo sapiens, you know, this desire to search and explore.
Yes, indeed.
And then you mentioned the intervals. So can you explain the intervals for us?
So the interval of a fifth would be five notes in the major scale. So for example, if we have do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, do to so is the five notes we're talking about. And so musicians would know that as a fifth.
And what drew you to that interval for this piece? What inspired that?
I think I was just playing some other bass line, and it reminded me of something that I was hearing in my head, actually. I think that's just where it started. And a fifth is a rather common two notes to play on a bass. It's very fundamental, so bass players play that interval quite a bit.
So do these melodies come to you? You're just sitting and noodling around a little bit, and then something clicks in your brain, and then you're able to create these melodies?
Yeah. So when it's working right, it tells you what's next.
And your electronic bass sound is so subtle and smooth and has a really buttery feel to it. Well, how do you create that sound?
Well, I like to think just because I take the instrument seriously, you know, and when I first started playing the instrument, of course, I just played in rock bands and so forth. And I don't think it was anybody's intention to focus on sound, you know, the intent there is on emotion and so forth. As I went on, you know, I started to think about the sound I was producing. There's a movie with Meryl Streep in it called Music of the Heart. And she plays a music teacher, and she has a sign in her music studio and it says, do you like the sound you're making? And when I saw that, I thought that was really great. But, you know, that's just kind of the key, you know, just trying to make a sound that I liked. I thought that it was possible to make a nice sound. And then, you know, when I was a young man, I heard Jaco Pastorius, and I was convinced of it then, you know, because he had done that. He had achieved that. He achieved an extremely musical, wonderful sound on an electric bass in the days when people thought that was not possible. Just the instrument was really maligned. I've since learned that there are a lot of instruments that people thought, you know, couldn't sound good or couldn't be, you know, main melodic instruments. The tenor saxophone, for example, you know, which is, it's, that sounds, that's a ridiculous statement today, you know, but at one time, you know, 100 years ago, no one thought that you could play a melody on a tenor saxophone and have that be the main statement of the music. The tenor saxophone was thought of as being an instrument of accompaniment, rather like the electric bass.
It's interesting. It brings us back to Edgard Varèse's piece that we listened to earlier, because it is a combination between organic sound and electronic sound in some sense. And
very much so. And I take a lot of inspiration from that.
And what drew you to the electric bass versus the upright bass?
Early on when I was in school, they asked me if I played an instrument, and I said, yes, I played the electric bass. And they went, no, that's not an instrument. So they gave me an upright bass, and I learned to play that as well. And I enjoyed that quite a bit. But there's a lot of reasons I like the electric bass. You know, for one thing, it's very American. You know, it's just kind of this hybrid, kind of bastardized instrument that's very Americana, and at the same time, quite wonderful, you know. So, and mainly up to this point, it's been used in quite a bit of popular music. But, you know, that doesn't preclude it from being used anywhere else. But, yeah, you know, we usually hear bass on pop records from, you know, from the early 1960s on.
And how long have you been working on this album?
I started this album about a year ago.
Wow, a year? That seems very fast.
It came together pretty fast. Well, I've been working on composing the tunes for a couple of years, but the actual production of the record came together within a couple of months.
And how do you know when it's time to bring people together, and how do you know when the process is done and that you have an album?
Well, I think it's time to bring people in when the compositions are done. After you play with the people, you know if you have anything or not. There are things that we recorded that I didn't use. So not everything is wonderful, right? But I expect that. So you can record things, and if I use 75% of what I record, it's really a high, wonderful percentage.
Yeah, there's a lot of editing process that goes on.
And I try to keep the editing on a project like this. I try to keep the editing at a minimum, because I don't really want to destroy, you know, the sense of the conversation.
It's interesting in filmmaking, you know, there's the great filmmakers, they have these uncut scenes where the camera follows different characters through an intro or a scene where there's no edits to the film. It's one long scene. I'm just thinking about how most of the music, popular music we consume today, really it is all cut up for us and edited and put together in some shape or form. You don't necessarily get that one scene unedited except for in genres like jazz or classical music.
It's true, and unfortunately I think a lot of that is because as an audience we have been manipulated into having shorter and shorter things presented to us. For example, the piece we just heard by Varèse, is about 8 minutes long, and that's just slightly shorter than Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan. And both of those would be incredibly long for anyone in a modern audience. Whereas, you know, maybe a TikTok video is how long, right? And so we look at that and we get the little thing and we get our dopamine rush. And then in a way, a lot of media has been created to satisfy our addiction.
Yeah.
And not in a good way.
And then in the piece Pentagraph, it's interesting because you're bringing us into that story of the piece. And then at a certain point, you're like, where is this going? And then there's the piano runs. And it just, to me, it sounded like rain or a waterfall. And it sort of had this feeling of, oh, I've arrived at this opening in the woods and there's this stream running through the forest.
You have such a wonderful imagination, Mira. That's great.
Yeah, you're walking for a while and then you are surprised by something.
Wow.
I guess that's dopamine. Is that dopamine? I don't know.
No, that's, you know, but I think dopamine would be maybe, you know, 15 seconds of the intro or something.
Yeah.
with you know, some visual accompaniment, and then that would be it.
Yeah, I wonder how, if more people were focused on delayed gratification, you know, that classic experiment with the marshmallow and the kids, you know, tracking the ones who just eat the marshmallow immediately and then the others who sit and stare at it for as long as they can.
Oh, I really think that if we had a little more open time, that would be very beneficial for us all.
I've been speaking with my guest, Steve Kim. Thank you so much, Steve, for joining me today on this show.
Well, thanks for having me, Mira. I really enjoyed being with you and talking with you.
It's been so fun. This is Human Music. I am your host, Mira Jo. You're listening to KVSH. LP Vashon, your listener-supported island connection.
KVSH LP Vashon, your island connection, streaming online at voiceofvashon.org.
In the beginning, back in 2015, you people didn't know about the Whiskey Hour show, Friday Night Live. DJ Moo had the frequency. And Whiskey had the blues, and no one knew what they were gonna do. But Voice of Vashon had the news. They said, let there be a night, and we chose Friday night. They said, let there be life hacks, and we have Pebble Moose life hacks. Let there be a dance party, and there's a 10 o'clock dance party. Let there be the Whiskey Hour radio program.
Friday nights, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. on the Voice of Vashon.
I'm Mira Jo, host of Human Music on Voice of Vashon. I love talking with other musicians about the creative process as we listen to music together. If you're a local musician, I invite you to be a guest on my show. Contact us at info@voiceofvashon.org.